Hi, this is Perry, and you're listening to the Chemist's Corner podcast for Tuesday, September 14th, 2010. Welcome to Chemist's Corner. I'm your host, Perry Romanowski, writer, joggler, and longtime cosmetic chemist. Chemist's Corner is a podcast about cosmetic science and is broadcast to help educate, entertain, and inspire current and future cosmetic scientists. The information and opinions discussed on Chemist's Corner are those of the hosts and the guests alone. They do not necessarily reflect those of any past, present, or future employers. Well, it seems like a long time since our last episode. Summer has been pretty busy here at Chemist's Corner. We launched a cosmetic science training program, which you can still get in. If you go to the website, there are some details there. We also started a Facebook page, and we're keeping up our Twitter pages. Additionally, we launched a YouTube page. So if you go to YouTube and you look up Cosmetic Chemist, you can find our page of videos. And of course, we kept writing up the blogs. If you haven't been to the website in a while, go check out all the new content. So the website is chemistscorner.com. This fall, we're going to have many more shows and lots of more interviews, so stay tuned. As always, today we have a fully packed show. We'll discuss some of the latest cosmetic science news. We'll talk about a cosmetic science topic, specifically how you can use ingredient labels to do some formulating. And we'll have an interview with Doug Shoon, an outspoken cosmetic chemist out of California. Let's begin with some cosmetic science news. I saw this article over at ScienceDaily.com, and I recommend to everybody that you should check out ScienceDaily.com for all your latest science news. According to this article, scientists are reporting the development of a fast, simple, inexpensive method for determining whether chemicals in consumer products and workplaces may cause skin allergies in people. This method is one that does not involve the use of animals. Their study appears in the ACS's Chemical Research in Toxicology, which is a monthly journal put out by the ACS. Chemicals in cosmetics can cause dermatitis by bonding to proteins in the skin and then aggravating the immune system, so the redness, irritation, itching, and other symptoms occur. There are existing chemical tests that could replace animal tests, which use substances like glutathione to mimic skin proteins. However, none are suitable for use in detecting the critical early stages of skin sensitization, at least according to scientists. Instead of glutathione, researcher Ida Chipinda, I'll say that 100 times, and his team developed a test with nitrobenzenethyl. I became a chemist just so I could learn to say those long words, and clearly I haven't learned it. Anyway, the nitrobenzethyl worked on 20 different chemicals known to cause skin irritation. The test produced positive results. It produced negative results when tested on substances that usually do not produce skin irritation. So it turns out that this chemical test might sometime replace animal tests for cosmetics, at least when it comes to figuring out if an ingredient is a sensitizer. That does bring me to a topic of animal testing, and I think someday we'll do a whole show on animal testing, because as a cosmetic chemist, you should really be aware of the controversy and the realities of animal testing. But I'm frequently asked by people when they hear that I'm a cosmetic chemist or I make cosmetic formulas, they say, why do you test on animals, or do you test on animals? I should say that in my career, I have never personally tested a cosmetic on animals. Unless, of course, you want to count me or other people. It's a misperception by the public that animal testing of cosmetics happens really frequently. In fact, it doesn't really happen that frequently. That's not to say that it doesn't happen. In fact, it does happen. But as a cosmetic chemist, you probably won't ever have to test on animals. When it does happen, the work is usually contracted out to a specialized house. The thing about animal testing is I've never met anyone who wants to test on animals. But we all want to ensure that the products we create are safe for people to use. Animal testing is traditionally the only proven method for determining safety, and in some cases, it's the only method that the government, particularly the United States government, will accept in ruling whether your product is safe or not. It's true that there is a big movement to get away from animal testing. In fact, the EU has even enacted some bans of it to different degrees, and they've actually had to stall the implementation of a complete ban of animal testing, which is slated to happen in the EU in 2013. But as this story demonstrates, progress in creating alternatives to animal testing is being made, so there are scientists out there trying to create alternatives. There's many more than just this study. And hopefully there will be a day when animal testing is not required. But for now, this is really the only option for companies that want to produce cosmetics that use novel technologies. There are some companies that will claim they never test on animals, and they're probably not lying. But the way they get around that is to use ingredients that have already been tested on animals and have been shown safe. Essentially, they're building their anti-cruelty reputations on the work, which they would consider cruel, that was done before them. In our next story, we have an interesting debate going on between the American Academy of Dermatology and the Environmental Working Group. In this story, reported on by the Cosmetic Design website, they report that the American Academy of Dermatology has defended the use of retinol palmitate in sunscreens, saying there is no evidence to suggest it causes cancer when exposed to UV radiation. Now, this was a response to a report by the Environmental Working Group, who is in the United States here, a consumer activist group. Essentially, they come out with reports warning people about how cosmetics are dangerous and are poisoning you. The Environmental Working Group, or the EWG, has put out a report that said a vitamin A derivative created when the ingredient is exposed to UV, it was a photocarcinogenic. The reason that you might use retinol palmitate in a sunscreen is that it has, at least many people believe, it's an anti-aging ingredient because it has an antioxidant which is believed to help produce photoaging effects. The EWG contends that it can result in the production of oxygen radicals, which can be carcinogenic. These conclusions they came to were based on a preliminary data from work done by the National Toxicology Program in the United States. The United States has the National Toxicology Program is always looking at different ingredients that people are exposed to and trying to determine whether there is a concern about carcinogenicity. The AAD, however, reviewed the research and concluded that there's really no evidence to support the Environmental Working Group's view. So it's another story here of a group trying to scare consumers. And in our interview coming up later, we'll discuss the motivations of these groups with Doug Shoon. All right, that brings us to the cosmetic science topic. Today we're going to talk about ingredient lists and how they can be useful to cosmetic chemists. Ingredient lists, at least in the United States, are required to be put on any beauty product. And they're supposed to be put on the beauty products in specific ways, and these specific ways are laid out according to the INCI dictionary. The INCI dictionary is the reference book that houses the official names of all the ingredients that are used in cosmetics. You can go to the FDA's website to see all the guidelines, but since it isn't a terribly interesting read, we thought we'd tell you about the basics here. So first the ingredients used. So on any ingredient list, you have to use the names that are published in the INCI. So when you see the word water, it should be water. Sometimes you'll see on ingredient lists the term purified water, for example. This isn't really correct, and you're not supposed to do that, at least here in the United States. You're supposed to use the INCI, and it's supposed to say something like water, if that's the ingredient. In the EU, they also use INCI names, but water in parentheses, you might have agua. So if you're looking for the names of ingredients, go to the INCI dictionary. Now, once you have the names, the order of listing is important. So in the United States, You're supposed to list things in order of concentration if they are above 1% in the formula. So things that are 1% or lower, they can be listed in any order, with some exceptions. Colors are supposed to be listed at the end. In general, people will put preservatives near the end, any kind of colorants. They'll put adjustment agents like citric acid near the end. They'll put claims ingredients near the closer to the 1% line. That's really all the rules that it's really all the rules required. And I should note that it's really based on the percentage of the ingredients. Sometimes people do a trick where they make a water solution of an ingredient, say aloe vera gel. They'll make a aloe vera gel, but they'll make a water solution of it, and then they'll list the water solution not as water but as the aloe vera gel, which implies that the whole thing is this aloe vera. But in fact, it's still, you have to go on the percent activity of an ingredient. So if water is the primary component of any raw material, you have to list the water as the top ingredient. So now that you know about the INCI names and about the order of listing, it's useful in formulating. There are a few things you can do with these ingredient lists. Well, first you want to find ingredient lists, and so if you can always just get a product and look at the list. But if you're online and you can't buy the product, I suggest you go to two excellent resources for ingredient lists. This is drugstore.com or ulta.com. That's ULTA.com. You can find ingredient lists on many of these. You can also find ingredient lists on maybe eBay or Amazon.com, just a couple examples, but there are lots of places on the internet where you can find ingredient lists. So for a cosmetic chemist, here are three things you can do with an ingredient list. First, you can use it to copy a competitor's formula. Knocking off or copying a competitor formula, it's a great exercise to teach you how to do cosmetic chemistry. It gives you a great sense of what the raw materials do and which ones are important, and maybe how they affect different performance characteristics. Really, there's no better way to learn cosmetic chemistry than just the trial and error process of copying someone else's formula. And if you use the ingredient list, just try to guess at what the formula levels are. And remember, use your clues. Use the 1% line, and you can do a percent solids test to figure out how much water is in the formula. If you take the pH and the viscosity readings, you can also get a sense of, how much salt or how much acid is being used in a formula. Then you would just go through and make, through trial and error, make just a bunch of prototypes and see which ones match your competitor. Now, I say that knocking off a competitor should be a learning process. It's not an end process. So I'm not suggesting you go through and copy other people's formulas to sell. What you want to do is copy other formulas so you learn how to make formulas. Ingredient lists are also a great place for new product ideas. Your marketing people are always going to be looking for new ingredients, and so whenever you come upon some novel ingredient which has an interesting name, you should write it down and maybe pitch it to your next new product marketing idea. Finally, the third thing I like to use ingredient lists for is just to learn new ingredients. Whenever you see an ingredient on a list that you don't know, take the time to look it up. Figure out why it might be in the formula. This way, you can use ingredient lists as a way to help you build your cosmetic science vocabulary. When you're learning to read, they told you whenever you read a word you didn't know the meaning of, you should look it up in a dictionary. Well, whenever you see a raw material that you don't know, you should look it up in the INCI dictionary. We're excited to have longtime industry expert Doug Shoon on the program today. Doug Shoon is the president and founder of Shoon Scientific, an organization that specializes in scientific, technical, and regulatory issues pertaining to the cosmetic, beauty, and personal care industry. He is an internationally known author and lecturer and has provided expert testimony in cosmetic industry-related cases. He has over 20 years of research and development experience and has been awarded 11 patents for innovations related to the cosmetic industry. He is co-chair of the Nail Manufacturers Council and also belongs to and participates in numerous scientific organizations like the American Chemical Society, the Personal Care Products Council, and of course, the Society of Cosmetic Chemists.
He is a frequent commentator on LinkedIn and a regular poster on Twitter. Welcome to the program, Doug.
Thank you, Perry. It's nice to be here.
Well, it's good to have you on the show. I'm excited. I've followed you a lot of your comments on LinkedIn, and I have always enjoyed what you had to say.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate that.
So, getting started, why don't you tell us how you got into the cosmetic industry? How do you go from being a chemist to the cosmetic science industry?
Well, I was actually working in the aerospace industry as a polymer chemist, and nothing against engineers, but I started doing some consulting work in the beauty industry, and literally I fell in love with the people. I said, these are really fun, interesting people. There's a lot of opportunity in the industry. So the defense and aerospace industry wasn't doing all that great, so I made a career change and started doing consulting in the cosmetic and beauty industry. Ended up actually working for one of my clients for the next 20 some years before I started my own company just a few years back.
Now, so when you got started, what kind of projects did what kind of things did you work on?
Well, when I first started in the industry, what really got me going was even though I was still working in the aerospace industry, I was teaching at a university, some laboratory classes, and the lady I taught for, his daughter, was a cosmetologist. So one of my very first projects in the industry was helping develop a safety program for this nail salon and hair salon. And in the course of doing that, so when I started meeting other companies and talking to other people and realized how interested I was in this industry. So I think my first project was really more of a safety related project.
And is there something about your previous industry that made you sort of more expert in that?
Well, because I'm a polymer chemist, it really helped me quite a bit because a lot of polymers are used in this industry, and especially going into the nail industry where they use a lot of reactive monomers and polymers. I was really perfectly suited for that, which is why the company wanted to hire me. They saw that I had a lot of crossover technology that I could bring from my aerospace work and use that to help make better products in the cosmetic industry, which actually did turn out to be true. So what I think is really, really important is to have a broad base of education. And because I had really worked in other industries before, I was able to bring some of what I've learned from those other jobs to this industry. And it was really very helpful for me and for the company I worked for.
But what attracted you to the cosmetic industry? Was it just that you knew somebody in the industry, or you specifically sought the cosmetic industry?
No, I was actually getting material safety data sheets from different companies. And one of the companies sent me these horrible MSDS sheets. And this was back in the 80s when MSDS sheets really weren't required. So I wrote the company back and told them of the deficiencies in their MSDS sheet. And they said, hey, we want our sheets to be great. Can you help us with this? And that really kind of shocked me as I expected something quite different. And when I started working with the company, I realized that they were really great people and they really had a need for a technical person, a lot of marketing people that didn't know the technical aspects of it. So I realized I really could bring some really great value to an industry that didn't have a lot of technical people at that time. That's certainly changed in the last 20 years. But at that time, there really weren't a lot of technical people in the industry that could be utilized in that fashion.
What kind of advice would you have for somebody starting out who just wants to get into the industry, say right out of college or from a different industry?
Well, I think what I would recommend you do first, understand the industry, scope it out, go find out what opportunities are available, and figure out where you want to work. Because when you say beauty industry, you may think hear something different than it really is. It's really a multifaceted industry. Many, many different kinds of jobs are available, many different companies, many different needs. So I would first spend a little bit of time finding out where I'm going to spend maybe not the rest of my life, but a good portion of my career. I would expect you would be in your first several jobs. That's going to be determined by where you want to place your efforts. What I mean by that is there's hair industry, there's nail industry, there's skin care. There's a wide range of opportunities. And I think it's best to identify where you want to work and then go for that area because that's where your passion will be. And you should always work where your passion lies.
Now, this organization, the Nail Manufacturers Council, I'm in the cosmetic industry, and this isn't an organization I had heard of before. How did you hear about them?
Well, there was a great need for the manufacturers in the nail industry to work together because they were being challenged with lots of different regulatory challenges and questions from media, et cetera. So the industry kind of pulled together some of the leading experts and said, "Why don't we work together?" Which to me is a great idea. I love teamwork. So all the manufacturers pulled together, donated their technical people and some of their legal people to work on industry projects as a group. And we've been in existence for, I estimate, well over 15 years and been very, very successful. It's really great to work with people who in one aspect are your competitors, but in another aspect are really very knowledgeable people and have a lot of expertise that they can bring to the table. So it's really worked out wonderfully. And it's an organization I'm sure will continue in the future because there will continue to be regulatory and scientific challenges.
Yeah, no doubt. And speaking of the regulatory challenges, one of the things that I notice frequently in the discussions we have on LinkedIn about cosmetics is the question of cosmetic safety. And in one of the blogs that I write, I get asked frequently from consumers about whether cosmetics are causing cancer and whether the chemicals that are used are safe. So I ask you, as an industry expert, are cosmetic products safe?
Well, I think there's no doubt that they are. In fact, I would say that I've been in meetings where I've heard people from Health Canada and from the FDA say, of all the products they regulate, cosmetics are among the safest products that consumers can buy. And I think that's absolutely true. That's not wishful thinking. There's a long history of safe use of cosmetics in this country, and cosmetics really are designed to be used safely. Manufacturers want their products safe, so the consumers will continue to purchase them. So I think it's a myth that cosmetics are somehow dangerous. And what I frequently tell people is cosmetics are far safer than bicycles or roller skates. But we for some reason are the attention has been focused on a lot of issues that really are, in my mind, not issues. What I say is, as a scientist, in my mind, really not issues. So I think we're missing the point here, that we can look at anything and say anything is dangerous. But if you really look at it from a relative point of view and compare it to other things that we do on a daily, risk we take on a daily basis, and other products we use, cosmetics certainly are rank among the very safest things consumers can buy.
Yeah, one of the things I remember you posting a few months ago was the report that polled toxicologists. And essentially, the toxicologists had said, that they didn't think the chemical exposure to cosmetics was a problem.
Well, that was actually a very interesting poll put out by the Society of Toxicology, a very, very respected group. They polled nearly 1,000 toxicologists and asked them what their concern levels were over various ingredients used. And actually, their concerns were very, very low. Where they expressed the most concerns were mostly on the misinformation that's being generated about the safety of cosmetic ingredients. And they definitely raised a lot of voiced a lot of concerns about some of the organizations that are what I term as fear-based advocacy groups, who are really generating unnecessary fear and paranoia simply to frighten the consumer. And that's why I call them fear-based advocacy groups. I myself consider myself an advocate, and I think advocacy has an important place in the world. But when you use fear to frighten people rather than try to educate people or make changes, I'm opposed to that tactic. I don't think it's useful, and I think it's counterproductive, and it really doesn't do anything except create a lot of unnecessary fear and does not solve any problems or address any issues.
Who do you think are the biggest spreaders of this chemical fear? Like,
Oh,
what organizations?
without question, the Environmental Working Group is probably the most irresponsible of them all. But the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics is vying for the title. These are clearly fear-based advocacy groups that will definitely err on the side of scaring you. If they aren't sure which direction to go, they're going to take the fear-based tactic almost every time. And I don't believe they have any credibility because of that.
And that's in the US. Do you think internationally, are there any groups forming internationally?
Well, all of these groups actually work together. That's one thing advocacy groups do very, very well. They work together and they share information. So I think the international groups are really the same groups. They may have different names, but they're all sharing information. They're all working together in a coordinated fashion. And that's something really the cosmetic industry should take a hint from. We should be working more closely together and more coordinated in our efforts because the people who are out generating irrational fear are doing a better job of reaching the consumer than we are.
That's certainly true in my experience on my consumer beauty blog. It's clear that people have bought into a lot of the fear out there, especially with some of the comments I get.
Well, people argue with me sometimes when I say this, but my thought is that people like to be afraid. If people didn't like to be afraid, there wouldn't be 13 Freddy slasher movies out there. People love going to horror movies. They like watching scary things, and it's part of our human nature. I'm not a psychologist, so I don't know why it is, but I believe these groups play on those innate fears that we have and use them to their own advantage. And it's really not to the advantage of the consumer, it's to the advantage of the groups themselves.
Well, why do you think these groups do it?
Well, that's probably a very difficult question to answer. I do believe, I'll say up front, that there are people in these groups who are true believers, who really, really believe what they're saying. But I believe there are the higher ups in these groups are not necessarily the true believers. We don't call these groups corporations because they're NGOs, but for all practical purposes, they're very much like corporations. They have budgets, they have bills, they have projects they're working on, and they need huge amounts of capital to do this. You cannot go to any of these advocacy groups sites and not the first thing you see is a donate button. And many, many times they're sending out all kinds of pleas for money and accompanying them, of course, with scary stories and reports to make you think that they're out there protecting you from some horrible danger and they need your money to do it. They may need your money to do their agenda, but they're not protecting the consumer from any horrible dangers. That's very, in my mind, that's a fact.
Yeah. Actually, I saw a discussion about the Environmental Working Group where they had a report about sunscreens and how they caused, are causing cancer. And then on their website, they have links so people can buy those same sunscreens that they claimed were causing cancer.
Well, they're certainly not very consistent, and a lot of what they say makes no sense at all. The Campaign for Safe Cosmetics came out with this huge report on lead in lipstick and an expose on lead in lipstick. Well, the FDA went back and looked at the exact same things that they had tested and said, well, the levels are a little lower than you reported, and the levels you're reporting are safe and expected. If you look on the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics website, though, they'll say that no level of lead is safe. That means even one molecule of lead is dangerous, which is clearly ridiculous. Everything has a safe level. So for these groups to take these really hardcore black and white stances is really just a way of them refusing to deal with the industry and deal with reality. If they start really talking to the industry on a fair and a fair basis, I think we could solve these issues. But unfortunately, these fear-based groups, I don't believe they really want to solve the issues. I think they just want to create controversy and create paranoia so they can raise more money.
Where do you think is a good place for people to find the real information about the safety of cosmetic chemicals? The Environmental Working Group has their Skin Deep database, and a lot of consumers will go there. They claim to get over 1 million hits to their websites a month. But where can people go to find the real information?
That's really the most difficult question you've asked so far, because the internet is the wild, wild west. It's anybody who's got a keyboard can put anything they want on the internet, and they can make it look like a $1 million website. They really put fancy graphics on there, so you may think you're reading credible information when indeed you are not. More and more, they're starting to become sites that do provide valid information. One of them is the cosmeticsinfo.org put out by the PCPC. I know it's put out by a cosmetic association, but I still think they tried very hard to be very accurate. I was one of the donators of information to that website, and I put my 2 cents in there, and they vetted the information out very carefully, and I think they did a good job. I believe they'll start to become more and more of these credible sites as time goes on. But I'll tell you how you can tell if you have a site that you should be wary of, and that's if everything they're talking about is fear and scaring. If they're not trying to inform you but trying to scare you, then you should ask yourself why. Why are they so focused on scaring me and putting out these scary reports? And are they working with industry? Are they doing something to try and make things better? Or are they just doing a lot of complaining and issuing reports? It's so hard to tell the consumer where to go to find good information. So I generally try to tell them how to tell when the information is not valid, and that's one of the best ways. If it's nothing but fear, you should be very skeptical.
And what do you think that cosmetic chemists can do about this?
Well, I think there's a lot they can do. First thing they can do is get involved. Too many times, cosmetic chemists sit back and say nothing. They may talk to their friends, but they don't really get involved in sites like LinkedIn, and start discussing and learning about the issues, because you may have something you can contribute through your expertise, but also there are others out there who are contributing their expertise that you can learn from. And the more cosmetic chemists understand about these issues, the better off our industry is going to be. It used to be the time where you sat on the bench and did your formulation and just did your job and went home. Now's the time for all cosmetic chemists to become very, very involved in these issues, understand them so they can speak to them, and speak to them to the media, speak to them who about them to whoever's asking, because we need better information out there. And that's, like I said in the beginning of this interview, who's doing a good job are these fear-based groups. They're getting their information, their message out. We need to be doing that as well, and in fact, we need to be doing a better job of it than they are.
Yeah, recently I saw a website launched. It was personalcaretruth.com, where some people have gotten together to, I guess, try to counter the EWG and the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics.
I've reviewed that site, and overall, I think it's a pretty good site. And what I most like about it, I made some comments on some things I saw that I didn't quite agree with, which, nobody's going to agree with everything. And I instantly got feedback back from the people who had provided that information. And that feedback is there available on the site for you to read. You don't get that from the Environmental Working Group. They really don't want you seeing the controversy over what they're putting on the website. And there's really no way for, there's no blog or a place for people to discuss that information. And I think if you did, they probably would remove those comments. So I would, that's another way I think that you can tell if the information is good. Look for, are there other people on there offering comments, and are there good discussions going on, like the site you just mentioned? I think that's going to be a sign for future sites, for determining whether the future site is something you want to participate in and gather information from. At least if you can ask the authors questions, you can decide for yourself whether this information is valid.
I would have to agree with your assessment there for sure. That site has a lot of good information, and I think it's a good start, but there are some things which make me feel a little uncomfortable.
There is another site that I would recommend people to go to, and it's called activistcache.com. That's a really great site, because you can go, if you have an activist group that you love and adore, well, go on activistcache.com and look at who their backers are, what their goals are, who what they're working on. You can find a lot of information about that organization. I think too many times people just jump on the bandwagon because something sounds good. There are some great advocacy groups out there, but there are some dangerous ones as well. And I think people should be a little more discriminating about who they give their money to and who they give their time and efforts to. Do a little bit of homework on the group before you get involved, is, I guess, my message.
And finally, this whole controversy about the safety of cosmetics, maybe it's not a controversy among the scientists who develop, but in the public, certainly. Is there any benefit? Is there any way that this benefits cosmetic chemists?
Well, if I had to look for a benefit, I think it's important for us to be discussing the safety of ingredients. I think it's important for us to be critical of ourselves and look at what we're doing and make sure we're doing the right thing. People can become complacent in any industry, and that's not good for the industry. So if nothing else, I think it's been a wake-up call to our industry to do some inward examination, go back and review data, and maybe be a little more cautious when we make ingredient selections, and think a little bit more about how well preserved the product is, so we don't have bacterial contamination. So I think it's good to have these discussions, but when someone starts promoting irrational fear and paranoia, that's when we're going over the edge, and that's when it becomes destructive. So as long as we're staying on the constructive, positive side and challenging and questioning ourselves, the industry is going to grow and prosper and become better.
Mm-hmm. If people want to get in contact with you, Doug, what's the best way to do that?
Well, thank you for asking. My website is www.shoonscientific.com. There they can ask me questions. They can read articles I've written. There's quite a bit of information on that site. So even if you're just looking for information on cosmetic ingredients or what's happening in the cosmetic world as far as news briefs go, I think it's a good site to check out. And there's a place where you can send me an email. I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Well, that's excellent. Well, thanks for joining the program, Doug, and we look forward to speaking with you again.
Thank you very much, Perry. I really enjoyed it.
Well, that's our show for today. We'll be back next week with another show and interview. Just a few quick announcements. The Complete Cosmetic Chemist training program is only open for a short time, but you can still get in if you register before September 30th, 2010. Go to the website to see the link to the page that explains all about the new Cosmetic Science Training Program. Also, I'm going to be emceeing the Midwest SCC's Falls Technical Symposium on October 26, 2010. It's held here in the Chicagoland area, and it promises to be an excellent show on the subject of open innovation. So if you are around the Chicagoland area, or you can get here, it's a great opportunity to see how open innovation can be applied to your job or business. And at the very least, it's a chance to see how an MC can work juggling into the event. Also, you should be getting in the mail, if you're in the Society of Cosmetic Chemists, you should be getting ballots for the national SCC elections. Take a look at who the candidates are, and please be sure to vote. Your voice is the only thing that can help the society grow. We have a chance to make this society much more useful to its members, and I encourage everyone to get out there and vote for the best leadership possible. Finally, if you have any questions and comments about cosmetic science or the show, go to thechemistscorner.com and leave your feedback there. Also, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and feel free to connect with us on LinkedIn and on our new YouTube page. Just look at the About page on Chemist Corner for details. Okay, that's the show. I'm Perry Romanowski, and thanks for tuning in. Now, go make a difference. It's not gonna make a